This is Jean Stuart Bauer, June 1982. I have the exciting pleasure of talking with a direct descendant of one of the first families to settle in Salisbury almost 2.5 centuries ago. He is David Brazy. We are at his home at the foot of Mount Riga. His whole life and that of his family have been part of this historic mountain, the iron of which helped to win the Revolutionary War. Good morning, Mr. Brazy. Now, perhaps I'd better clarify that statement before we go on, if you don't mind. The settlers of Salisbury made 3 petitions to the General Court in Hartford before Salisbury finally became a town and was granted a charter in 1741. The first official petition was made on May 13, 1736, and one of the 14 signers was Tinus P. Brazy. Now, it happened in October 1960, I interviewed your mother, affectionately known as Grandma Brazy, for the Lakeville Journal, and she told me some fascinating tales about the mountain and its history. She said the name was not Tinus, but Tunis. Would you set us straight on this and tell us what you know about your family history?
Born in Salisbury, Connecticut, in a house owned by my grandfather, Henry Brazy, at the end of Mount Raggy Lane on October 29, 1904. I was close to 5 years old when we moved into a home that was owned by Mr. Bert Sillick on Washington Road. Near Mr. Sillick's feed mill was very close to the road. The house was built of brick and stone on the first floor and wood on the second floor. The cellar was built in the back of the house. The only heat we had was an old stove, kitchen stove, and it was very cold in the wintertime when the fire went out.
Now, were you the first child, or?
No, Lena was older than I. My sister Lena was older than I.
Your sister Lena, and you were the second child. And were there any more?
Oh, yes, there were four.
All right, tell us who the rest of them were.
And I had a brother, 2 brothers, younger than I, and they were born about 2 years apart.
In the same house?
In the same
Washington House.
Each morning in cold weather, we could walk up to the Mountain Riga Road to Mr. Sillick's property, who owned the land, and drag back dry poles of chestnut wood to cut for short, into short lengths for the stove. Some of us didn't get the wood cut, so Mother did it for us, and she done it for us many times. Dad worked as a miller and all-around man for Mr. Sillick. Mr. Sillick stole cattle, pigs, chickens, eggs, apples, potatoes, wood, kerosene, and other things, besides all kinds of feed. The feed mill was run by water power, and some people called it grist mill.
Where was the water power?
You know where the old red building is on your left-hand side road coming up?
Yes.
17 to 44 on it?
Yes, yes.
Well, I worked in that. I ground feed. With it, you know, the old stone ground.
Yes.
Or ground feed with that too myself.
Oh, that's great.
Well, yeah, old enough.
Okay, let's go on.
Some feed was run by water power. Some of the mill was run by water power, and some by hand. 2 large stones about 5 feet in diameter and about 12 inches in depth ground the feed. As a rule, the bottom stone was stationary and the top stone turning. The grain dropping to a slot near the center of the stone and was then run between the stones down to a chute where an elevator carried it to the bagging chute. Every so often the stones had to be picked up and made sharp edges on them so it would grind the feed better.
You've been pretty young then, weren't you?
I went to work when I was 9 years old.
You did? Yes. So when you were
young.
And you were grinding wheat and picking up these big stones?
No, I helped my father.
Oh, you helped your father.
Yeah.
Yes.
I worked for Mr. Tillich up till I was 16 years old.
16, uh-huh.
I mean, I worked for his son until I was 16 because Mr. Tillich passed away.
Yes, yes.
When there was plenty of water for power, the mill would run all day and all in way far into the night. I've seen 4 or 5 wagons of grain and corn come on the cob come to the mill at about the same time. Some getting their ground feed the same day and others coming back later. I've seen my dad and old Ted Moore covered with feed dust, and when they worked at night, the only light they had were candles. In back of the feed mill was a brook. After coming down over the dam, ran over some stones and very large boulders, making large holes and eddies. And from
I didn't understand that about the eddies. I mean, what did they have to do with it? Anything?
Yes, it was my life, it did.
Oh, I see. All right. Maybe this is exciting.
The dam was down, was known as the big, below the dam, and it was a place called the Big Hole. And about 200 feet below the dam was where it was situated. And here's where, from 6 to 14 years of age, where I had many happy days in my childhood. I could sit here on the bank of the Big Hole for hours, fishing and listening to the water coming over the dam and over the rocks to the Big Hole. It was a song I never got tired of. In the winter, thick ice formed on the brook, and snow fell on the ice, and you had a feeling the brook had gone to sleep. Don't let anyone tell you a brook can't sing. Sit beside one someday and cast out all of the thoughts out of your mind and listen. Here at the Big Hole, I caught my first trout, 1 pound and 1 ounce. Mr. Tillick weighed it on the scale for me. In fact, these scales weigh just about everything. Pigs, chickens, and cows, and every person from baby to grown-up got their exact weight here.
Were they the ones that you step on? I mean, you could drive a wagon onto?
No.
No?
You had to drag your bag of feed on top of it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
A fair guess would be 25 to 30 trout caught in a big hole, but I felt I had caught thousands. I even fished there in the wintertime, digging my worms close to the sawdust pile where the wood was cut for Mr. Silly. About 400 feet below the big hole was the Jenny Dexter home. And here was a small dam in the bridge that crossed the brook. On clear days, I would lay on the bridge, and if the trout would not bite, I would take my hook and get it under his jaw and hook him. And I hooked Mr.
How could you catch him?
Well, in the clear water, you could see the trout very plain.
Oh, I see. And
if he wouldn't bite, we'd get the hook under his jaw and yank up.
That's an interesting way to catch fish.
Across the brook from the old feed mill was a field called the bird lot.
The and what here, lot?
The bird lot.
Oh.
And here I shot my first woodchuck. I had been shooting a .22 rifle from the time I could hold it on a support and aim. But on the day of...
Who taught you? Your father, I suppose.
Father.
Yes, yes, yes.
But on the day that I was 8 years old, I took my dad's old 12-gauge hammer gun and 2 shells, number 2 shots, with 3.5 grams of black powder. Crossing the bridge at Jenny Dexter's, I could walk through the fields and bird lots, and while resting on a large stone wall, I'd see a large chuck sit up and look around and drop down to feed again. Very carefully, I laid down the old gun across the wall and put back one of the hammers. Dad had always told me to be sure the hammer clicked before you let go of it. Holding the gun as steady as I could and taking aim, I fired. The world seemed to explode, and the gun and I went over backwards. I felt I'd been shot instead of the chuck.
It was a pretty big kick, huh?
When I was able to get up, I climbed over the stone wall to find the chuck very dead. Dragging him home was a great fun with a job. But home I went with the chuck feeling I was a real big game hunter. I went on my first fishing trip to Pat with Dad to Mount Riga when I was 5 years old.
What was the lake up there? There were two lakes.
The lake we went to was called the Upper Lake.
Oh, the Upper Lake. Oh, and which one did you go to?
The North Pond.
The North Pond, okay.
It's called Riga Lake now, but...
Yes, well, we're all fancy now.
And
that's where
it was about 4 or 5 miles from our home. It's called Forge Lake, and then the first lake is called Forge Lake, and the other lake, North Lake. I was on North Lake that we fished, on a small ledge called Patterson Rock. It would take over an hour to walk to the lake. Arriving there about an hour before sundown. Our poles or cane poles or ash poles with the bark peeled off.
You made those yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Dad would bait my hook with night crawlers and take any fish I caught off the hook. Perch, bass, sunfish, and bowhead.
And what?
Perch, bass.
And what was the last one?
Bowhead.
Oh, bullheads. Yes, excuse me.
When it got dark, Dad would lay down an old coat on the green moss back of the ledge with the lantern close by me. I would lay down on the coat and Dad would cover me with another. The green moss in the old coat was a wonderful bed. The whippoorwills would call back and forth across the cove. The owls hoo-hooed over in the inlet, and the frogs spent with their deep jug of rum were the noises of the night, and I listened to them and I fell asleep.
That's very poetical.
I want you to read one of my poems.
Yes, sir.
Sometimes I would wake and hear Dad and Uncle Rube and Uncle Fred and Ben Smith talking about tales about hunting and fishing and just about everything. The lantern would be covered with insects attracted by the light, and I would fall asleep again. Some nights, if Dad and our friends started storm-like catches in the mountain, they would start home early. I can remember holding Dad's hand and closing my eyes and walking. It seemed I got home a lot sooner. If there had been a rain during the day, old stumps and dead logs would be all aglow with phosphorus. Dad called it phosphor, but I had the thought it was animals with glowing eyes.
I remember that too.
On clear nights, we stayed all night. Dad would awaken me just about daybreak, and when we would start home with a basket full of fish, mostly bullheads. The walk up the mountain made me tired, but the walk down was a long road to me.
Now, you were only 9 at this time.
I was 5 years old.
Oh, 5. Oh, my goodness. Yes, go on.
And Dad would carry me when I got tired and make this mini load with a basket of fish, but it was all worth it in the end, as a mess of fish fried nice and brown with home made bread and butter, and mashed potatoes made a dish that's for a king. And Mom was a good cook. She could do so much with so little. I was not 5 years old when I first walked to the mountain desert with my mother. Grandmother Brazy and Aunt Nancy and I went to visit it with my great-aunt Liza. To visit my great-aunt Liza.
Yes.
Who lived up there.
Where she lived, at the top of the mountain?
Yes, she lived in there's nothing but a cellar hole there now.
Oh, I see.
But,
yes. What was her last name?
Liza Spita Rossiter.
Oh, Rossiter, yes.
She was related to the Rossiters that lived up in Belleville Road.
Now, is that the Rossiter, the descendants of the Rossiter that's still here?
Well, see, they lived in Old Gaston up years ago. Some of them were born on the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, only Paris Rossiter was only there. He could tell you so many tales. Don't know, right? I went to visit my great aunt Liza, who lives up there. I still remember the large sugar cookies she gave me. On the way home, they were...
What did she give you?
Large sugar cookies. Remember the sugar cookies that had rough sugar on them?
Oh, yes.
Square, little small, tiny square box. On
yes.
They were vanilla cookies. You don't see them anymore.
No. And they had sugar sprinkled
sugar
on the top?
Sugar sprinkled on top of them.
And what did you call them?
Sugar cookies.
Sugar cookies. Okay.
Yeah.
So she gave you sugar cookies.
On the way home, they would fill their large aprons full of dandelion greens, cooked orange salads, and it tasted wonderful. After the first heavy frost in the fall, the chestnut burrs opened up, and the ground would be covered with the brown, shiny nuts, and the old Hancock place was a favorite place to get them, and many bushels were picked up for the winter use or to sell. In a few years, the blight hit the trees, and the Americans suffered a great loss. Hickory nuts and butternuts were allowed, also picked up.
Was that?
I have still chestnut trees there, but they still have the blight on them.
They still have the blight after how many years?
The blight hit the United States around 1895.
Yes.
And from that time on, I've seen chestnut trees 4 foot in diameter. And make wonderful lumber, they did.
Yes. Oh, chestnut was great.
Chestnut
yes.
was wonderful.
Yes.
For hunting, trapping, and so on, ice houses are another thing. If the fire went out, you wakened to break the ice in the water pail and fill the tea kettle. Very soon, the old stove was a roaring welcome, and with felt boots called socaloons, and your feet and on your feet, and your warm coat on your back, you were ready for the other day.
To get up again.
Snow was taken from the roads at this time, and coasting was something really to have in the wintertime. They would be old and young on anything they could coast on, having the time of their lives, and the only vehicles we had to worry about was horse and sleigh.
Horse and sleigh, but you had your own sleds. Were they homemade?
Yeah. some of them were, and then we had the old flexible fire season.
Oh,
you know,
yes,
we went out of business, you know.
I remember that.
Oh, golly.
Yes.
It was too bad. The colder the night, the faster the ride. During the early 20s, a great deal of cordwood was cut and sold, and whenever new growth was started off, it would be loads of rabbits or cotton fields. On a good hunting day, four or five men boys would take tracks of the rabbits and take and track the rabbits into their holes and set the ferret in to get the rabbit out. That's as far as I got.
Did you say that you wanted to say something more about the rabbits?
Yes, I have a little more here on my back.
All right.
On my mind to say.
Yes.
Sometimes there would be two or three rabbits in the hole, and you certainly had your hands full for a few moments to catching them.
How did you catch them? With your hands?
With your hands.
Oh, my.
You know, I can remember well two rabbits. One, I caught the first rabbit, and the second one struck me right square in my nose, and I had a terrific nosebleed from it.
Oh, my goodness. That's the first time I've ever heard of a rabbit giving a man a nosebleed.
Many times we come home with a dozen rabbits or more, and they were then divided among the hunters. Let me tell you, a rabbit pie was something to fill up with on a hot winter's day, on a cold winter's day. Across the brook from the big hole, and on that dexterous land, some large oaks stand and chestnut trees stood there and made a wonderful place for a summer camping spot. Here we have a stone fireplace laid up, and from every garden, potato and corn field, we had our share of eat. But I alone was to blame for the chickens taken for the trees. With my old fish pole and 200 feet of linen line on the reel, I would lay my pole down and taking the hook would creep along the bank of the brook to Mr. Dexter's chicken coop yard. That bordered down to the stream. There I placed the hook on a large night walker and then crept back up to the pole. As soon as the chicken swallowed the worm, I had a pole that danced the chicken reel. But up the brook comes a, only to lose, up she comes only to lose her head by someone's hatchet. We really did not take too many hands, and only once in a while a rooster.
Oh.
Our dessert was the blackberries and kept black cats that you could pick most anywhere in those days, with red African apples and many other apples available.
Were those wild?
They were wild apples. You see, you have to cut a wood job off. These blackberry vines would come up, and in 2 years' time you could pick your load.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them.
Mm-hmm. What about blueberries? Didn't you have blueberries?
Not around here. You had to go on top of the mountains with them.
Oh, I see.
The old factory pond was a close by in here.
You mean the factory pond, that's the one by the Lakeville Journal?
No, back in the Clinton. Mm-hmm. See, there was a factory there at that time.
Yes.
A nice kind of factory.
Yes.
You learn to swim. I believe learning to swim should go right along with other school lessons. That's the end of it.
Mr. Brazy, is the name Brazy of Dutch origin?
York State Dutch.
They...
The Brazy said it was York State Dutch.
But now where do you think that Tunis came from? Did he come from New York State originally in 1736?
There's a little history to this now. We had an uncle, my father had an uncle, a brother, whom we called Tunifer.
Tunifer?
You know, he was so afraid to come home in the dark that he'd whistle all kinds of songs on his way home to scare off anything that he thought was going to come after him or something.
And he was called...
And I often wondered if it come down the line from...
From the Tinus was turned to Tunifer.
Yeah. Bill Barnett told me that Titus Brazee, that he pronounced it Titus Brazee, was one of the... was among one of the first founders of Salisbury.
Yeah.
My daughter Kathleen went to New York to look up his field in there.
In the New York Library.
And she found that the name was Breezy.
It's spelled B-R-E-Z-E-E.
Yes. Which, there were so many changes in everyone's name.
Well, that's true. Even on the list of petitioners, one man spelled his name one way and his brother spelled it another way. Yes.
Well, we had relatives up in, you see, our relatives moved up the Hudson River to Albany, then followed the post road out to Monterey and Beartown in Massachusetts.
Oh.
And that's, the man come out of my yard one day and he says, you've got a big head like me, and you're short like me, and you're heavy like me. He says, I said, Jim, what can I do for you? And he said, is your name Basie? And I said, yes. Well, he said, my name's Basie, too. And he had a package of those little telephone cards, you know, that
yes. You
write down on. It was just deep, all about the Basie name. He'd just come from Alaska. And he was working for the United States government as a physicist. And
how did he, and he had gone back and traced his history and figured
he found out that some of his ancestors had come from Beartown.
Oh.
And he lived in Maryland.
Yes.
And he was very interesting stuff too.
Well, he must have been. Tell me now about your own family. Let's start with your wife, Kathleen. What was her last name?
Bell.
What?
Bell.
Bell, B-E-L-L. And where did she come from?
Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Oh, she did. Uh-huh. And now tell me your children, and can you remember the dates that they were born? I guess that's, I can't even remember my own, too.
So. Get the old Bible in, yeah.
Do you have was the first child born?
With Anna.
Anna?
See, I was married twice.
Oh, I see.
Uh-huh. My first wife left me after David was born, so I had two children to bring up by myself.
Oh. All right. Well, we talk about Kathleen now. Kathleen was you were married to Kathleen in February 20th, 1941. Now tell me about your children that were born with Kathleen.
All right. Is it ready?
Yep.
Kathleen Basie, our daughter, was born August 16, 1942 in Sharon Hospital. Elizabeth Basie was born October 25, 1946 in Sharon Hospital. And Daniel Basie, our son, was born November 17, 1947 in Sharon Hospital. Theodore, our son, was born September 9, 1959. And Margaret was born January 2, 1962. Sharon Hospital. He was the first baby born for the new year.
Mr. Brazy, you started to tell me that you were married before you married Kathleen and had two children, and I got off on another tack. I'm sorry. Would you tell me who your first wife was, what her name was, and the two children by her?
My first wife was named Delia Lovett.
Did you love it?
Did you love it?
Yes.
And we had two children, David and Anna and David.
Anna, your grandchildren. Maybe you could just tell us how many does Anna have?
Anna has six children.
And
five boys and five girls and a boy.
Yes. So the Brazee name goes. And what?
David has three boys.
Yes. There's so then he carries on Brazee.
And Kathleen has three children.
Three children.
Two boys and a girl.
Uh huh.
And Elizabeth has two children.
Now, Elizabeth is Cricket.
Cricket, that's right.
That's right, yes. Told me, Mr. Brazy, some very, very interesting stories of your first memories of your grandmother and your father. What's probably the most exciting thing that's happened to you? Of course, you told me about the fish, which is exciting, and getting knocked over by the gunner and all that. But as maybe a teenager, did anything exciting happen to you that you remember?
One of my hunting experiences?
Yeah, well, anything.
Well, one day while I was on the mountain hunting, I saw this huge buck deer coming down off the side of the mountain. So I felt that we had our winter's meat. And so I shot him and down he went. And I thought, sure, I'd killed him right away. So I went over and you have to bleed them out.
Yes.
Get the blood out of him. And while I was doing this, he come back to life again.
Oh.
And he tried to strike me with his horns, and I held him so he couldn't. And he took me down the hill about 300 feet before I got my knife out to cut his throat.
The day you wrestled the deer.
And I had to wrestle that deer, and I ended up in a huge brush pile. And I was really bruised up then.
How old were you then?
About 29 years old.
Oh, I see.
It was on my 29th birthday, if you want to know the truth.
Oh, for goodness sakes. Tell me, you told me about your first job, which was very, very young. You were 5 years old and you were working in the granary, or the mill, rather. But after you grew up, when did you start to work on the mountain? You became warden?
I worked for the old Judge Warner. That is the real old Judge Warner, way back in 1921. And I worked for him for a number of years. And then during the Second World War, they let me go to Mount Riga.
Oh, you call it Mount Riga. Now, that's another thing I wanted to ask you. I thought...
You know, Mrs. Bellhurst,
yeah.
I have a feeling some sophisticated person changed that name. I still have that feeling that Raggy was not the right word for it.
No.
And they wanted to change it to a more sophisticated name.
Yes.
And they said, well, let's make it Riga. Because there's no Latvians up there, no Estonians, or no...
That's right. And your mother said that she thought it was Riga. I asked her about that, Riga, and she said, no, I think it's Riga, but you call it...
Well, in my way, I call it Raggy.
Raggy.
Because they'd always say, here comes a Raggy man.
Yes, I understand that. And you took no offense at that.
Oh, no, no.
No, no, it was just...
In fact, I'm glad I am one.
Yeah, good for you. You and Lila Nash. Yes. You got your first job on the mountain from Judge Warner?
It was through his son I got the job on the mountain.
All right.
Philip Warner.
Now, what was the job on the mountain?
Taking care of all the camps and seeing that they were taken care of, getting the wood for them, cleaning their camp, getting ice for them, and cleaning their stoves and things like that, and laying their fireplaces. And I've seen so many changes up there. It changed from wood stove to gas stove, from ice boxes to gas boxes, refrigerators, gas refrigerators.
Yes, yes.
And everything was changed. I mean, it was so much different. I used to give all the children a ride on the ice truck up there. And it was a wonderful thing. They all still remember it. Now they've grown up and have children of their own.
Did they harvest the ice up there on
no.
the pond?
When I first went, they told me I'd have to fill all the ice houses. And I knew it was going to be a real chore. So I called up the ice company in Torrington, and they delivered the ice right here onto my truck. I took it up that way, which is much cleaner ice than...
Yes, and you kept it in sawdust, or...?
No, I had two big heavy canvases.
Oh.
Padded canvases, I carried it up that way.
Uh-huh. Now, and then you became warden. Was that when Mount Riga was made Raga? So what will we call it? Mount Riga or Mount Riga?
I call it Mount Riga.
Mount Riga. All right. When was Mount Riga, when were you made the warden? And the association was formed, wasn't it? And Mr. McCabe was the president, Frank McCabe.
Mr. McCabe came to me and he said, Dave, we're going to have some campers up on the mountain.
They what?
We're going to have some campers
yeah.
up on the mountain. And that was the time he made me warden to watch over things.
What time was that? What year?
I would say around 1950.
Yeah. And then you devoted all your time to the mountain.
All my time was taken up with the mountain.
Yes, yes. And
I had a few small jobs that took care of
yes.
me, but not too much. Anyway.
Yeah. And you looked after the houses and saw that nobody was went
breaking
into them
in
and there. Disturbed them. And
there had been a number of break-ins up there, but that you can't stop.
No. Now tell me about the wild animals that you remember
oh,
from the mountain.
Well, cleaning Schwab's camp one time, is it cold out here too?
Oh.
Well, cleaning Schwab's camp one time out here, we heard dogs are barking. So I ran over through the woods with my .22 rifle, because I knew dogs had it. I could hear the deer, we say bellowing.
You called it what?
I said we could hear
oh,
the deer.
Oh, the bellowing, yes.
The deer.
Yeah.
And I said, darn dog, they've got a deer down there. They're having their young ones this time of year, too. So I ran over there, and on the corner of the road going into Travis Camp, there were three dogs. They had a huge doe down, and one dog was backing into a small cliff of rocks where it went into a small cave or entrance there. So I shot two dogs, because at that time I was warden of Salisbury, too.
Yes.
And they had a right to shoot dogs
yes.
that were killing wildlife.
Yes.
And the other dog that was trying to get this animal in the cliff of the rock started running, and I shot him, and I found him a little while afterward. And the mother had it, well, she was chewed up terrible. But in the cliff of the rock was this little baby doe deer. And it had a broken leg and its neck all chewed up and everything. It was in just far enough so that the doe could just reach its neck. So I said to my mother, or to my wife, I said, I want to put this out of its misery. And she said, no, you're not.
Your mother, this is...
No, my wife, I mean.
Oh, yeah, Kathleen.
Said, no, you're not, you're going to take it. And so she kept it for 6 weeks, like a baby. And then in the 6 weeks, it was...
What did she do, splint its leg?
I splinted the leg with water glass.
Yes.
What you used to preserve eggs with.
Oh, yes.
And we had the deer for 7 years.
And he stayed right here? Oh, was she? A doe?
She.
Yes. And she stayed?
We raised it like a dog, on a leash and everything. And she'd ride around in the truck with us, and she was just like a dog.
And
She'd come into the house and jump on the bed and use it as a trampoline.
What did you call her?
Bambi.
Bambi. Is that... Mm-hmm. Oh, isn't that cute? What happened to her eventually?
Eventually, she had a cracked vertebrae in her neck.
Yeah.
And I think that's what made her pass.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was almost like losing a member of the family.
A Gene Beeman, the game warden.
Yes.
I don't know whether we should put this on tape.
That's right.
But he'd always come on the yard and say to my wife, how is everything? My wife would say, don't you think you're going to take my dog away from me? And it was so, he was a wonderful fella.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful fella. You know we were taken well care of.
Well,
you know what, when you lose them, it takes a little out of your life.
Yes, it does.
It does take a little out of you.
Yes.
Life.
Well, I understand that you are very, very fond of all animals and wildlife. Did you ever run across any bears up here on the mountain?
No, but there was a boy come on our yard, a young Hubbard Wells. Said, you wouldn't believe this, Mr. Brady, but I saw a bear on the mountain. I said, I believe you, Hubbard, because another lady just stopped here not long ago and told me she took a picture of a bear. And
how long ago was that?
About 5 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And Barbara Griggs did take a picture of a bear.
Yes.
And it just showed the black shadow, but it was enough to show it was a bear.
It was a bear. Did, what about wildcats?
I have one I've trapped in 1959. I was coming off the mountain, and I see this animal jump on the side of the railing. And I said to my wife, good Lord, I said, a schnauzer dog doesn't do that. That's something else. And we got a little closer, and they jumped off the railing, and I said, that was a bobcat. And so I went back up and tried to see if the dogs would catch it, and it took off again. So during the winter, that following winter, they had killed two deer on the lake.
Mm.
And so I set some traps, and they didn't go near them. So I said, well, I'll try something different. And the Canadian people put out a trap called the Hover Heart Trap, it's a very humane trap.
Well, did you catch one?
I caught one.
Good.
And it weighed 39 pounds.
Well, that was a big... What did you do with it?
Well, I had it mounted by Mr. Bond.
Uh-huh.
And Dr. Brewer kept it for a while, and then someone stole it out of his camp and said, well, Dave, you keep it because it's your cat anyway.
So do you still have it?
I still have it.
Well, for goodness sakes. And
have you got to picture that well, Cat?
And what about rattlesnakes? Oh, isn't that adorable?
That's my lover boy in younger years.
Yes, he was a handsome.
Yes, Petunia.
Where'd the skunk come from?
We picked her up as a baby over at Mrs. Purdy's. Miss Clemmer? You know where Miss Clemmer lives on Wilson?
Yes, the beavers.
And
so what did you have to do? You had to get rid of the beavers?
We broke the gate trying to raise it. Broke the gate.
When was that?
Oh, it must be 15 years ago.
So you had to keep the pond cleared, too.
So we had to kill some of the beavers and trap some of them to get them out of there.
Yes.
And one beaver weighed 61 pounds and 11 ounces.
Did your wife get a beaver coat by any chance?
No. And you know, in skinning the beaver, it takes a long while to skin a beaver.
Yeah,
and all they,
yeah.
And all they offered me was $2 a piece for the hide. So I said, no, you're not even getting them. I buried them on my own property.
Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, snakes. Well, the rattlesnakes.
I have crawled these mountains all my life, ever since I was 5 years old, and I've never seen a rattlesnake.
Isn't that interesting?
I'd be lying like everything if I told you I'd found any snakes up here.
So,
some people go up for the first time and see a snake.
Uh-huh.
But I crawl these mountains up.
Have you seen any other, besides your skunks and your beavers and your elks and does and wildcats, have you seen any other animals up there that are unusual?
Well, coming down off the mountain one night late, after checking up there, this huge black animal comes from the right-hand side of the road, across the road about 100 feet down below me. It ran down towards the ravine. And I think I always thought it was a bitter. But that's the only thing I can ever see. But we've had raccoons, we've had owls. Oh, we could have seen it. We had an owl that was so tame. You know, when I shot a chipmunk, we were covered with chipmunks here.
Mm-hmm.
And when I shot, he seen me coming on the yard, he'd fly right to me. He knew that chipmunk was there waiting for him.
Have you seen any eagles?
Yes.
You have?
I'll tell you what. On the ice truck one day, we were going down Welders Road, and this eagle...
What year was this, do you remember?
Well, at least 25 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. This eagle was in a dead tree, and he flew out of the tree right in front of the truck. And he turned around and looked right straight back at the truck as he was flying down the road. See how close we were to him?
Was it a bald eagle?
A bald eagle.
Really? Bald eagle.
And a huge thing, too.
Yes.
And he didn't fly as if he was afraid or anything, but
uh-huh.
He wanted to see how close that big thing was to him anyway. Every child on the truck see it.
Mm-hmm.
They were all screaming their head off.
Now, in the Depression, of course, you've told me about that, how you worked to... shooting things and raising things and you managed to raise your family
Well, it was tough sometimes.
It was tough, yes.
I can remember one time when I had 7 cents and I wanted to get a can of tomato soup, but it was 8 cents and I couldn't get it. That was real tough.
What did you do?
Well, we used the 7 cents for what we could get and ate what we could.
Yes, and you managed?
I'd go fishing or anything else. Anything that was shot then went to the pot.
Yes. How long were you the warden for the mountain?
I'm still...
You still are the warden.
I'm still the old man of the mountain.
Oh, good. You're...
Mr. McCabe has never given me a walking paper yet.
Yes.
And...
what do you do now?
See, Ted is so agile and he's so much younger than...
Ted takes care of...
Takes care of the campsites. And,
yes.
And my son Danny helps me out a great deal looking up. We have 22 camps we take care of.
Verzee, how many children are home now with you?
Two.
Who are they?
Ted and Margaret.
How many of your children live in Salisbury?
Well, Kathleen, Elizabeth, Margaret, and Danny, and they all live in Salisbury.
Mm-hmm.
David lives in Norfolk, and Kathleen lives in Albany.
Yes.
And
so they're all close enough to come back.
Oh, yes,
when was the last time you had a reunion?
About 2 weeks ago. Yeah.
Really?
A cookout here on the yard.
And how many came? How many did you have there?
About, must have been at least 15.
15?
15 with the children.
Yeah, 15 with the children. Well, that was, I certainly am happy that the Brazee family is going to go on and on. You've been here almost 2.5 centuries now.
I built this house in 1929.
You did?
Yeah. I built every chicken. I'm not a carpenter, and there's any mistakes in my house, but it's a roof over my head.
All right, and tell me again, what house were you born in?
I was born in a house that belonged to my grandfather on Mount Raggedy Lane. It's a dead-end road.
At a dead-end road? Where was the dead-end road? Up there nearby the cemetery?
No. You go down here, down the road here about 1,000 feet. You turn right and cross the little bridge and go up to the end of the road.
Oh. Is the house still standing?
Oh, yes, it's still standing there. Max Marshall lives in it now.
Who?
Max Marshall. Oh.
Of all the people that you met on the mountain, that lived on the mountain, were any very famous or odd or...
The most famous people I've met on the mountain were the state police.
The state police?
The state police. They were the most accommodating people I know of.
What?
The state police and the conservation officer.
And they
have a tough job. They really do have, and that's a tough mountain for them to get into, to up there.
How often do they patrol?
As often as, they're always willing to help out.
Yes. Now, that's another thing I wanted to ask you. Have any people in the last 20 years lived there all year round, up on the mountain?
No.
You close up everything when the...
The first time I took over the job on Mount Riga, July and August was the 2 months that they stayed at their camp.
Yes.
Now they go up in April. As soon as they can drive up there, they go up there as quick as possible.
Yes.
And they stay right up there until way after snow flies has come over.
Have you... Brzee, I know that you are very, very modest, and Mrs. Brzee knows it too. So she has just shown me some of your memorabilia. There's a letter from Governor Meskel when he was in office honoring you for serving as a dog warden for the town of Salisbury for the past 26 years. That was in July 1973. There is also a picture showing Lila Nash giving you the beautiful silver cup with a gold dog on it, and of course pictures of Bambi, the beaver, the skunk Petunia, and the huge wildcat. Thank you very much, Mr. Brzee, for sharing your memories with us here in your garden to the accompaniment of that merry bird song, and I'm sure the people of Salisbury would add their thanks to the old man of the mountain, as you called yourself, for taking such good care of their Mount Raggy all these years.